Censored, which is an internationally known media research program that annually identifies the most censored news stories in the United States. It's an absolutely fabulous initiative, which in effect provides us with an alternative understanding of crucial news stories which have been completely camouflaged by the mainstream media and which under the leadership of Peter Phillips have been brought to public attention. Peter Phillips edits an annual collection of articles which is then published. He is also the author of a 2006 bestseller, which is entitled Impeach the President, The Case Against Bush and Cheney. Peter, welcome to the Global Research News Hour. Peter?
Introduction.
Oh, yes. You hear me?
Yes.
Oh, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much.
We're delighted to have you on the program. We have just a few minutes before the first commercial break, then there'll be a bit more time. Perhaps give us a little bit of a feeling of the Project Censored program and how it has evolved in recent years.
Well, Project Censored is now 32 years old, and we research annually the most important news stories that the corporate media in the United States doesn't cover. And we put out an annual book called Censored. The current one out on the bookshelves is called Censored 2008. And Censored 2009 is actually to the printers, and we'll see copies of that in the next 60 days.
And there must be quite a number of stories which the corporate media doesn't cover, I presume.
Well, yeah, they're so busy covering Britney Spears and you know, Paris Hilton that there's little opportunity, particularly on television, to do any in-depth coverage of important news stories that affect the people of the world. And that's probably been the message for 32 years. We're expanding Project Censored. There's been over 200 researchers here at Sonoma State that have participated, but we're also now incorporating other university classes all over the country. So we have about 15 affiliate universities that are this year going to start doing research on stories as well.
But then, in effect, what you're suggesting is that the students at Sonoma University, at the University of California at Sonoma, they are, in effect, establishing what constitutes a relevant issue which the corporate media has decided to camouflage.
Well, this is something the students really do get involved with. You know, you'll have a 20-year-old who comes into class, has never seen any independent media, you know, other than maybe, you know, late-night television or something, and starts reading news sources from all over the world, and within, you know, a few weeks, hearing from all the other students the stories they're working on, there can be a real transformation, and some of these students get very involved. They'll stay with us for semesters, then go off into the world doing, having a broader awareness of what's really going on.
That's absolutely fabulous. Could you tell us a couple of the really important censored stories which have been which are on this year's list and how important they are?
Well, the number one story and for the Censored 2009 book, which I think is a significant story, is over 1 million civilian deaths in Iraq.
Well, have to go to first commercial break. Our guest, Peter Phillips, stay with us. After the break, we'll be discussing the 1 million deaths in Iraq.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization based in Montreal. This is Michel Chassadovsky. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. We are talking with Professor Peter Phillips from the University of California at Sonoma, who is also the director of the Project Censored Award Program. The website is projectcensored.org. Just before the break, the issue of mass killings in Iraq was raised as one of the most significant issues or stories which the corporate media has camouflaged, which is also the object of an article by Professor Peter Phillips entitled U.S. Perpetuates Mass Killings in Iraq. Could you, Peter, perhaps elaborate for our listeners the size and magnitude of the humanitarian disaster in Iraq?
What we're faced with now is very strong evidence that over 1 million Iraqi civilians have died because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. These are people who died in excess of what had been the death rate under Saddam Hussein, even under the sanctions. So, and most of these people, well over half to two-thirds, have died because of U.S. action, mostly aerial bombing. So it's when a bomb is dropped and it falls on a house and kills everybody in it or in a neighborhood, there's no reporters on the scene to describe that. So the only way to really determine these deaths is to do a national survey, which was done by Opinion Research Business, which is a fairly prestigious British polling group that's been around for 15 years, kind of like the Gallup poll in the United States. And they polled over 2,000 families in Iraq, randomly selected, just like a normal poll is done, and came up with a number that you got a 97% accuracy rate. And their numbers range from 900,000 to 1,100,000. And that was as of a year ago. So they actually did this poll a year ago, last August. So given that those rates of death, and we have prior polls that were done by Johns Hopkins University. There were two studies done, one in 2002 and another one in 2006, which at that time had put the civilian death rates at 650,000. So all three polls are consistent in that they're showing massive death related to our occupation and the war, and that these are approaching levels of, you know, mass killing, genocide, if you would use that term, and that this is... They're fully aware of this. I mean, this is 10,000 civilian deaths a month. And so if we continue with the current two presidential candidates, one saying that we're going to stay the course and easily could kill another million people, and the other saying that we should get out within 18 months, which is 2 years from now, that means that a minimum of another 250,000 Iraqis will die because of the U.S. involvement in Iraq, in that country.
Now,
it's appalling. I mean, it's just appalling.
The Lancet study, I mean, I think we should remind our listeners that the Lancet study was conducted. It's a very prestigious medical journal that was conducted by a team from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. If I understand, it came up pretty much, if you extrapolate those figures, they come up with pretty much the same numbers as the Orb study. Is that correct?
Well, the last Lancet study was completed in October of 2006. This study was done as of August of 2007. You're certainly looking at compatible results of several hundred thousand people who have died, and then if you add another year's toll since the surge, we've increased aerial bombing. The U.S. has increased aerial bombing, so the census surge, we can only believe that the civilian death rate has increased. So we're easily can say with great accuracy that the U.S. has invasion has resulted in the death of over 1 million human beings in Iraq.
Now, Peter, if we take into account the number of people who are wounded per every death.
Oh, that would be, you know, 10 times as many.
10 times as many. And then the number
multiple
of displaced people and refugees.
4 to 5 million people displaced from their homes, living inside of Iraq, so internal displacement, another 2 million plus living in a neighboring country, Syria and Jordan. It's horrendous destruction to a population that was only, you know, 25,000 people, and now we're seeing
25 million.
I mean, 35 million, yeah.
Yeah, the population is 25 million, and essentially what you're suggesting is that up to a quarter of the population are either dead, injured, or displaced, or have fled the country.
Correct.
Yeah, something of that order.
Right. It's something of that order. And we don't get any, and the media in the U.S., I mean, it's like most people get the impression that this is Iraqi upon Iraqi killings and bombings. When in fact, most of these deaths are attributed to American aerial bombing.
Yeah, well, the other aspect of that is the impact on people's lives. The fact that they're unemployed, that they don't have electricity, they don't have water, they don't have health services because all those things were destroyed in the aerial bombings.
Well, we know that over half a million people died in the 90s during the Clinton administration's sanctions, and that has, you know, the levels of medical care and the infrastructure in society are even in more terrible shape now than they were then.
And there's also been another thing, a related aspect are these targeted assassinations of professionals and intellectuals in Iraq, which have contributed to literally destroying the whole social infrastructure because the human resources are no longer there.
The human resources as doctors, educators, healthcare workers, engineers, people who had means have left if they could get out of the country, and they had incomes that would support that. So your upper middle class, your middle class has fled. And you're left the country literally poverty-stricken without adequate infrastructure for utilities and health care. That is devastating.
How do you, in some regards, we know that this war is a criminal war because it doesn't have a justification under international law, and it used the pretext of weapons of mass destruction to invade Iraq. But on the other hand, there's another process which I think pertains very directly to the work of Project Censored, is what I describe as the criminalization of the media, because it is criminal to uphold the lies and to distort the truth to such an extent that people don't know what's going on.
Well, it's like the corporate media in the U.S. is so consolidated now. We're down to 10 major media corporations, completely interlocked with the corporate 1,000 biggest corporations in the U.S., increasingly dependent upon sources of news from official government and corporate organizations and public relation firms. So you have a deep embeddedness of the corporate media in the U.S. military-industrial complex. In fact, we can even call it now the U.S. military-industrial media complex of the United States.
Is there overlapping? I mean, some of the defense contractors, do they have a stake in the media and vice versa?
Definitely. I mean, there's people from the Carlyle Group, Bechtel, Halliburton, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, that sit on the boards of directors of some of the biggest media corporations in the United States. So there's a direct penetration. I mean, this global war, this war on terror, has profited Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, two of the top three defense contractors immensely. Their stock has increased to 300%.
And so I presume that they take their surplus profits and invest it in other sectors of the national economy, such as the corporate media, I presume.
Well, corporate media is very profitable. The most profitable industry in the U.S. is the war industry. It's the military complex. The corporate media, the big systems are second, literally. They're the most profitable systems in the country. And, you know, that and insurance, banking, healthcare, they're totally invested across the board. So what you've got is a top-down capital growth and expansion based on war policy in the United States that the American people are almost, you know, unanimously opposed to, strongly opposed to. Two-thirds say, you know, in this war now, with not a full depth of understanding the degree to which a very small group of neoconservative individuals interlocked in these big corporations, policy councils, and the defense industry is dominate.
We'll have to go to a break. We're speaking with Peter Phillips, who is professor of sociology. I should correct, it's Sonoma State University. That's my... I'm looking at it from a Canadian perspective. It's Sonoma State University and director of Project Censored. We'll be back after the break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chostodovsky. This is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest is Professor Peter Phillips from the State University of Sonoma and the director of Project Censored. We were discussing the issue of Iraq and the cover-up of the media regarding more than 1 million deaths in Iraq, most of which are due to aerial bombardments by U.S. forces. In your article, you raise the issue of impeachment, which is now part of an initiative of Representative Dennis Kucinich in the U.S. Congress. Could you perhaps address some of the underlying implications of these war crimes with regard to the impeachment procedure?
Well, we knew 2 years ago that the civilian death rate at that time was 650,000. That was one of the motivations for Dennis Liu and myself to write the book, Impeach the President, the case against Bush and Cheney. We weren't the only ones in the country that were addressing those issues back then. But we felt that the only way to end the Iraq war quickly and immediately was to impeach the people who had lied about the reasons of going to war in the first place, documenting that and moving onward with a new president and bringing the troops home from Iraq as quickly as and safely as possible. That has not transpired. The Democrats apparently could not push that agenda or chose not to. Somewhere inside the Democratic Party, they decided that the war in Iraq was a good campaign issue and that it would help ensure a Democratic president elected in 2008. That's most unfortunate because it's continued to kill hundreds of thousands of people annually over there. So that's concerning. We would still like to see Bush and Cheney impeached. That should happen immediately. The Justice Committee last week met and discussed impeachment. The articles of impeachment are there. Kucinich has put forward 35 articles 2 weeks ago, and then he put forward just the one article
That's
about
right.
lying to go to war in Iraq. And all the evidence that we have now that the administration deliberately misled us and lied to us.
If I understand correctly, when he initially put forth the 35 articles, then Nancy Pelosi, which is, of course, the chair of the House of Representatives, actually blocked the initiative. Is that correct? And then he came back with his one article of impeachment.
Well, they voted. Actually, what happened on the original articles was that the Republicans voted to refer it to committee. There's debate within the Democratic Party that impeachment proceedings will backfire on them and that their presidential candidate will lose because of that. I think there's some people that really believe that. Unfortunately, they waited so long to even allow this to come forward. And, you know, there were impeachment resolutions submitted 2.5 years ago. Cynthia McKinney had filed impeachment resolutions as one of the last things she did while in Congress. But so the opportunity has been there. We've known about the death rates in Iraq. We know the lies about the war. There are plenty of reasons to impeach Bush and Cheney. We could change the title of our book once they're out of office to the reasons for the indictment of Bush and Cheney for criminal charges, and that's what Bugalosi's book is about. He's saying that George W. Bush is guilty of murder. And
right.
Spoke at the hearings last week.
But, well, when you look at this historically, if you examine the various cases of impeachment in U.S. history, one wonders if it seems that the standards for assessing impeachment have changed over the time. The more serious the crime, the lesser the likelihood that impeachment will proceed. I mean, certainly Clinton got away. He didn't get away with murder, but he was targeted for something which was quite innocuous if you look at it in broader foreign policy terms, which is his affair with Monica Lewinsky.
Certainly, there's never been a successful full impeachment of the president where the Senate voted by 2/3 to impeach him and remove him from office. That's never succeeded. It missed by just a few votes back in the 19th century. The Clinton, of course, was not impeached. But and maybe it's safe to say that Nixon might have been. But even there, he resigned, of course, before it went to full-blown impeachment. I think many people in Congress consider impeachment an extreme action, most difficult to obtain, and only necessary when you can. Ensure success and proceed. So there's a lot of foot dragging that goes along around this.
But there's also a lot of complicity of lots of people. I mean, we're not dealing just with the head of state, the president of the United States, and the vice president. It's all the entourage, it's the advisors, it's the members of Congress who accept to go along with all this.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct on that.
We'll have to go to another commercial break. Our guest is Professor Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored, author with Dennis Liu of a 2006 bestseller entitled Impeach the President, The Case Against Bush and Cheney. Which
you're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is coming to you from Montreal. It's an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. I'm Michel Chosadovsky. Our guest, Professor Peter Phillips, author and director of Project Censored, which is an initiative, an annual award granted to writers and journalists on the 25 most censored stories which the corporate media does not cover. We were discussing issues pertaining to impeachment, which is the object of Peter Phillips' book, and the issue of Denis Kucinich's initiative in the U.S. Congress. we are now down to Article 1, which is now being debated in the House Judicial Committee. Is that correct?
That's the one that's getting the most attention. That's the, you know, lying to get us into a war that resulted in the deaths of U.S. military people.
And that's also the one of where, I mean, that's the article where essentially the President of the United States is accused of lying to the U.S. Congress. Is that correct?
Correct.
I mean,
correct.
So that in effect, I presume that this was negotiated with the leadership of the Democratic Party to get it to have it go through to the Judicial Committee.
I'm not sure exactly what transpired in Washington in the last 2 weeks behind the scenes. But clearly, by creating simply one article instead of the 35 articles that Kucinich had put forward before, it simplifies the process and focuses on the most grievous of lies. That's bringing a country, invading another country without using our military resources without adequate cause. There was no imminent threat. There was no weapons of mass destruction. They had no capabilities of hurting the U.S. in any way. They had nothing to do with 9/11. And all of those implied things, both implied and directly lied about, were you know, broadcasted by the Bush administration, by George W. Bush himself and Cheney. And Rumsfeld and Rice, all of them. So there, you know, that is grounds not only for impeachment, but criminal indictment.
Absolutely. Now, criminal indictment could take place outside of this framework. We could take all these people to a civilian, presumably to civilian court.
Well, there's certainly a million civilian deaths is as great a crime as, you know, the World Court or the, you know, the court in The Hague has addressed. And certainly there are countries around the world that could indict our leaders and put them on trial for the entire world to see the evidence.
Denis Kucinich has gone through a very, very detailed presentation of articles. I mean, there's 35 articles of impeachment, and now we're down to one article of impeachment, but it's a very crucial article. Is the article now being, I'm not quite sure whether the article now being discussed by the House Judicial Committee, is it the same article as Article 1 of the 35 articles?
I think it's pretty close.
It's pretty close.
I haven't compared the two exactly, but yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it really focuses on the administration lies about and going to war against Iraq. And that's the cutting edge of why we need to impeach immediately and take those people out of office. And we'll have a new president elected by January. And in the meantime, there can be a placeholder president. Actually, it would be, if both Bush and Cheney were impeached, Nancy Pelosi would be acting president for that time.
The subsequent articles, I mean, the subsequent articles, in effect, what they go into tremendous detail, but I see that Article 2 raises the issue of 9/11. And of course, maybe for some Democrats, that's a little bit of a controversy, but what Kucinich had in mind there was the fact that the 9/11 attacks, were used to, in a very distorted way to associate Iraq with an imminent, security threat to the United States, and saying that Saddam Hussein was implicated in 9/11. If I recall, there were several media reports actually which pointed in that direction. So perhaps, how do you see that kind of issue, the 9/11 issue, which is obviously something which the media has also obfuscated over the years?
The certainly 9/11, the failure of the administration to heed warnings from just about every European country, Israel, Russia as well, that an attack was imminent, for the Bush to fail to respond to his daily briefing papers that said bin Laden determined to attack in the U.S. They had very specific warnings. And those of us that have, you know, looked into these issues are quite aware that not only were the warnings about hijacked airplanes, but that the target, the World Trade Center, would be used again as a symbolic target of American capital imperialism worldwide. And that has, you know, undoubtedly the failure to intercede or do anything at that point raises a suspicion that an event of that magnitude was, you know, certainly happened without major resistance by the U.S. administration, and clearly they benefited from that, both the military-industrial complex, but also the administration benefited in that the Homeland Security Act and the Patriot Act, these things were pre-planned, pre-written, ready to go in force to develop one of the largest security bureaucracies in the world.
And that was planned. That was planned before 9/11, was it not?
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. That was planned before 9/11 took place.
Okay. Yes.
And I presume, because if we look at military planning, the war in Afghanistan took place started in October 7th. In other words, there was a lead time of what, less than a month between 9/11 and the actual invasion and bombardment of Afghanistan, when every military analyst will tell you that it takes at least 1 year to plan a major theater war.
They've been planning that war for over a year. The war in Afghanistan and a war in Iraq had been planned for a long time. We were quite ready. The neocons who ended up in power with George Bush had pushed quite strongly the committee for the invasion of Iraq, had pushed Clinton quite strongly to invade Iraq back in 98. So there had been a long centered objective of the neoconservative movement, the global dominance group, the people who want the U.S. military to dominate the world, to take over Iraq, to control the oil there, to take over Iran, to control the oil sections, to keep China out. I mean, this has been their agenda for a long time.
But that is not something which the U.S. public knows, because the corporate media has fed them the lies and fabrications underlying the so-called war on terrorism. I assume that if Americans knew the real justification for this war, which is a driven control of oil resources, and that they had access to the Project Censored stories on a more extensive basis and daily basis, this would in effect reverse the tide of public opinion in America, and whatever support might be granted to a war agenda.
Yeah, propaganda, top-down propaganda, is persistent. They will tell the lies over and over and over again so that it becomes common sense to most people that the Iraqis are bad, the Iranians are bad, that their leaders are crazy. It just becomes the mantra for global war and expansion. To do the economic analysis, to look at who benefits from this war, to say who's in power and how it's concentrated, those are the things that researchers can do, and we can lay it out. But without the continued reinforcement of that message and that understanding, we become small voices in a magnitude of mind control from the top down propaganda machines of the most powerful people in the world.
But then that raises the issue, how do we reverse the tide? How do we actually spread the message? And in effect, it also suggests that perhaps the anti-war movement should not only be directing their energies at politicians, but at corporate media interests, which are in fact distorting reality to such an extent that people are not able to act in a consistent way against the war.
Well, there's some lies that are so horrendous. The corporate media, I mean, they can't address certain things. They won't talk about election fraud in 2004 when the election was overtly stolen by over 9 million votes were changed in voting machines in 13 states. The evidence for this is overwhelming, but you cannot get corporate media to address these issues in any way that undermines the economy, undermines the credibility of the presidency, or undermines their own credibility in terms of a media system. That becomes the big lie. So a perpetuation of that, we the activists, the people who address these issues, have to continue to push. We have to continue to try to democratize, to have transparency in government, to really engage in every way that we can, to, you know, ask for a new investigation of 9/11. I heard Ralph Nader yesterday say that 9/11 needs to be expanded, needs to be a new investigation. And more people around the country are saying that. And that's just one part of this terrible global dominance agenda that benefits a very small number of corporate elites in the world to continue to keep us in the dark.
Incidentally, Peter, sorry for interrupting you, but in Canada, one of the major opposition parties, the New Democratic Party, has introduced a motion they've introduced the debate in the House of Commons on 9/11. And because they are now convinced that the Bush administration is involved in lies and fabrications, and so that it is got to the mainstream. This is an important party, it's the leftist party, but it represents a sizable component of Canadian public opinion.
Well, the same thing happened in Japan. Parliament member Yoshisha Fujita called for new investigations into the death of Japanese citizens on 9/11 in the World Trade Center. And he put forward all the evidence. There were 24 Japanese citizens killed. This was on national television in Japan, presented to their parliament, calling for an investigation. So, yeah, the rest of the world knows what's going on, or is really suspect. And us in the United States are like mushrooms. They keep us in the dark and feed us a lot of you-know-what.
Where would you start if you had to identify the major sources of disinformation? Some people talk about the top feeders. In other words, a number of major news and media groups feed information or disinformation into the system, and then it sort of moves around. It's a network. Who are the main culprits in this process of disinformation? If you look at the major, let's say, the major newspapers, the major networks.
Well, certainly the most conservative is Fox, but we have to take a look at all of them and say, where are their sources? How is this information processed? Corporate media is in the entertainment business. They're principally trying to attract people to sell them products, and that's how the system's maintained. So we have to re-examine the structure of the entire system in terms of how we do news and information in the United States. We definitely need more of a tax-supported, public-supported news-gathering system to support democracy. That becomes vital, truth and information. So I see us building independent media, funding investigative journalism, investigative research. I see universities having a role in that, as well as journalists and ordinary people at a grassroots level. I just returned from Cuba and looked at their media system there. I spent 5 days in Havana, visited all their radio, the big radio stations, and that. They have 90 stations on that island that are community-based. So all the news is coming from the bottom up. The people at a local community will broadcast a news story. It goes to Havana and can be spread around the entire island. So that's a bottom-up news system. We clearly need that kind of information and news worldwide. And there's a whole movement to that. I mean, there's, you know, the media reform movement, the media democracy movement worldwide is building that kind of system. We recognize there's now a truth emergency in the world, and that this truth emergency demands that we find our own ways of telling our stories, and we supersede and we undercut corporate media and make them irrelevant.
Well, that's certainly it's those are very incisive comments that you've made on the process. I guess that when we get down to looking at how we actually do this, it's much more difficult because the media groups, of course, are very powerful in terms of their financial resources, in terms of their links to the military and intelligence and the government and to corporate interests in general. So that, I think that grassroots process, can occur, but the question is one of reach and access, through television as well as through the printed press. I think that we will be going shortly for, a short commercial break. I think we have a few more minutes, a couple of minutes before the break. No, the break is coming on right now.
There you go. Okay.
Yes. So
we'll
have to go.
That.
Even our program has sponsors. We have to go to commercial break. We're talking with Professor Peter Phillips. We'll be back after the break to conclude the Global Research News Hour. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chossadovsky. This is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest is Professor Peter Phillips, director of the Project Censored Award Program. The website is projectcensored.org. At this website, you will be able to order the latest Censored 2008, which is a book edited by Professor Peter Phillips. It has the Statue of Liberty. I'm looking at it right now. It has the Statue of Liberty with blood flowing from her eyes. You will also be able to. You also have details on previous Project Censored collections, Censored 2007, as well as Professor Phillips' book, co-authored with Dennis Lowe, which is entitled "Impeach the President: The Case Against Bush and Cheney." That's at the Project Censored website, projectcensored.org. I should also mention that these various titles are also available from Amazon. Welcome back, Peter. We have just a couple of minutes before the end of this program.
Your comments as we were leaving, Michel, and then your comments about the cover of the 2008 book with the Statue of Liberty really bring us to that question of where do we go or what's evolving here. And the Statue of Liberty image really reflects the loss of civil liberties in the United States, and the suspension now of habeas corpus, the planning for mass arrests, the detention centers, the transformation of the laws, and then, as you wrote in your award-winning piece this year, the executive order criminalizing the anti-war movement by being able to seize war press protesters' assets. All of that threatens personal liberties in the U.S. And with the decline of the economy and the more difficult times ahead for us, that creates the situation where both libertarians and progressives addressing issues of personal freedom can find common ground. And the big issues like 9/11, election fraud, top-down propaganda of the corporate media, can become common ground in an effort to protect human rights and civil liberties, not only here in the U.S., but worldwide. That's our agenda. That's the direction we need to go. That's the truth emergency that we're
And we just hope then that the Statue of Liberty will look a little bit more cheerful when we establish that democratization of the media. I think the Statue of Liberty looks a little bit sad there with the blood running from her face.
She's certainly damaged.
But it was. Yeah, it's but it's a very it's very provocative graphics and it says a lot. The fact that the U.S. Constitution has been flushed. You referred to the changes in the FISA, I mean legislation as well, indirectly, how in fact freedom of speech as well as the right to assembly and so on is being. Is subject to the Big Brother type of arrangement. I think we're at the end of the program. We thank our guest, Peter Phillips, professor of sociology at Sonoma State University and director of Project Censored. Join us back next week for the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chosadovsky. See you next week. Stephen Lenman will be hosting the program. Gold has been.